Welcome again to our podcast. Today, we're very privileged to have a very special man on board, Mr. Bernie Plunkett, who served in the Corps for a full career plus. He's a highly decorated man. He's a member of the British Empire. He also holds a master's degree in science and another degree, a master's degree in literature. He's not bad looking either. Good morning, Bernie.
Great intro. That's a good bit of lying on your part.
Just give me a quick reminder again of your career. I mean, in the early days, you were a grav in a rifle company, I believe, weren't you?
Yeah, I was 19 in 73 when I joined. Yeah, got through training. I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. I'll tell you why, it was a blast. And my first tour was with 4-5 Commando. Went to Cross Maglen in 1974. Then I hit it again. I doubled up on that, and I'd done the 40 tour with 40 Commando in 76 under Julian Thompson. That was a great tour. That was the first tour that the Royal Marines didn't lose anybody.
I didn't know that, really.
I had a few guys wounded because Cross Maglen got mortared. Various stuff. I think first 10 years in the Corps, I went as a corporal to 4-1 Commando. Done my Duke Command course. Went to 4-1 Commando, and I was in the infamous F Company for a period of time, which I... Seriously, it's the best time of my life. It was absolutely brilliant, you know. And we still get together for reunions now. I mean, various things during that period of time. I became a PTI, went to Limpston for 4 or 5 years, went over to do Naval Intelligence, Snoney, Senior Naval Officer, Northern Ireland for a couple of tours. Ended up doing special duties in Northern Ireland for a good long whack at that. And that's really how I finished it. When I was in the Corps, I had the great pleasure of being attached to a special boat service for a couple of years. I went down there on a two-week deployment. One of the colonels, he said, look, Cullors, do you want to come down? He said, and just put this course together for the guys for a couple of weeks. I said, yeah. And then at the end of it, he looked at the, you know, what we'd done over a couple of weeks. And he said, do you fancy making it a bit longer than 2 weeks? I said, how long? He said, well, what, about 18 months? You know, it was absolutely brilliant. I loved working at Paul, loved the guys. I was with M Squadron, basically. We had a little thing called counter-terrorist wing, where that's where you do all your sort of room combat stuff. You know, you've got a lined room. You can shoot 360 without shooting each other. And you can go through the drills there all day. You know, we had access to helicopters. We had access to weapons. So it was a really, really good cracking couple of years. I've turned from the 19-year-old guy, and over a period of 24 years, I've become this gnarled old colour sergeant. About 6 years with special duties. My unit was called the Force Research Unit. So our job was like running agents within terrorist organisations in Northern Ireland. That was absolutely brilliant. Great bunch of guys. Selection's a bit fierce at the beginning, so you know your fitness levels tend to help you. But then, you know, as the course progresses, the intelligence score guys tend to do better on the other stuff. You know, it's like every sort of special duties forces unit, 53% of the SF now is bootneck, you know, or ex-bootneck. They are what they are, you know. But
that's an interesting observation, that, Bernie, because from my own brief experience down at Poole, the reality is you could find any cap badge involved. I went through the SC3 course with a naval nuclear submarine engineer who'd never held a weapon in his life. And we had on that particular course a guy who'd been a Royal Marine chef. He'd actually badgered the Major General, which is quite something for a Marine to do, bombarded his office with letters before he finally was allowed to go and attend. It's defining quality is that thirst for adventure, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that love of the sea, that's why I never done it, really. We talked about this before, didn't we? We talked about your affinity with the sea. And I mean, like, you know, the recce troop days. Sorry, I was in 40 Commandos recce troop as well. Used to love that. Used to, because it was a military thing. So if you were on a rigid raider and you were tearing around, or you were silently going into a coast on an exercise, or you're climbing a cliff, you know, as a lead climber. Yeah. I mean, that was the epitome of what being a commando was. So I'd love that.
Yeah,
but, you know, I wouldn't want to do it weekends. You know, I just want to get home to my family at the time. You know, see my kids. Or these guys that spend all their spare money on big carabiners of some sort, or another bit of rope. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. Yeah, but it's a thirst for adventure, and it's the joyfulness of it. I think sometimes a simpler life is a more rewarding life. So, you know, if you're a Marine in a fighting company, or you're a Marine in a recce troop, or you're a guy who's successfully done an SC3s course and you're part of a hugely sort of effective unit and you've got all the kit you want and everything, there's happiness about it, you know. And at that stage, everybody done PT, 6 o'clock in the morning, we all got together and we done it. I took it sometimes. I got beasted other times by somebody else, especially the swimming stuff. You know, you'd swim a length and then you'd climb a rope and then you'd do dips. Well, I would do everything to try not to do the swimming. Of course, I was a troop sergeant. So I managed to get away with it until one of the lads say, how come you're not wet? You know?
Doing daft things of that nature when really I should have been sat on the sofa with the kids. It's almost an impossible balance to get right. I think when you get to that kind of level of, you know, professionalism in the military, it can take over very easily. Quality of life then was pretty much one-sided for me. You know, it was fantastic from a professional point of view. But I think we got used to going away so often that you didn't tend to think about it. Just to give you an example, I got married in North Devon. The unit was at, I mean, like 48 hours notice to move. And my troop sergeant said, you can go, but if I phone, you get back ASP. I didn't get the phone call. I arrived back in Arbroath on a Sunday night, having got married the previous day with my new wife. There was a knock on the door and it was a recall. And by breakfast, I was on another sail heading across the Irish Sea into Belfast. And that was the start of her married life with me.
My kids, my wife and kids had a bad time of it. I was a fanatic. I bought them some Action Men. And before I gave them to them, I had to paint green berries on these Action Men because I wouldn't give them to them just with the army one.
My eldest girl, Emma, right, she joined the cadets. You know, there she was on the bottom field crawling underneath, across the monkey bars and falling in the tank trap or whatever. But one day shopping in Exmouth, I just happened to look in the window because I'd noticed people coming towards me sort of giggling. And I looked in the shop window and I saw the reflection and Emma was marching behind us and she was marching like the best recruit, you know, with her arms straight out here somewhere. And I turned around to my own daughter and said, stop that. You're embarrassing me.
Have you seen that movie, The Great Santini?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was thinking of Major Dad, actually. It's a similar sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, my kids, like, I'd get them in the back garden, you know, and I had a couple of binos that I'd signed out from the store. And, yeah, I'll say, okay, gentlemen, look to your front. 15 objects out to the front, and I want you to try and get them. And they're a little notebook, you know, and they're all sort of... And they would love it, to be honest. There's still a couple of Action Men hidden in the bushes because they didn't find them, so...
I know, I took Emma and Lisa for a yomp across the moor once, the first half of the 30-miler.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Emma was, you know, being a bit older than Lisa, she had a bit of an advantage. But I went to the stores, the company stores, and I got out all the gear. So they had a proper Puss's Bergen and an Arctic Slug, which weighs a ton in itself, and all the rest of it. And I remember the shock on their face when I got it out the back of the car in Okehampton Battle Camp and said, right, we're going up that hill, and off we went. It was about 10 miles. They did fantastically well. We made the most of the opportunities we had. Certainly in my case, for the, I would say, 2/3 of my married life, at least I was away from home. And I developed that facility for switching off.
When I left the Corps, I went on the security circuit. And that finished. I ended up going as a media consultant with NBC News out during the last war. And that was interesting, you know, because, you know, I was looking after a news team through a proper... kinetic, everything happening, artillery, Paladins, Abrams tanks, Bradleys, and I'm in a little Land Rover Defender that, unbeknown to me, that was the vehicle of choice of the Iraqi army as well.
So it wasn't
a particularly good thing to be driving around in, to be honest. And we had loads of other things. We had a big satellite dish. Now, remember, we're going back now before World Wide Web and all that sort of stuff. The only technology like that was maritime technology, yeah, where they had these big scanner-type things that could pick up signals. And we had one of them enclosed in a plastic dome on the back of one of these huge Ford Ranger trucks that looked just like a chemical laboratory. So there's me in this... Land Rover Defender with a chemical laboratory. and another big old truck that the other guys used to get around in, including the correspondent. Correspondent's name was a guy called David Bloom, and he was a star because he was the first person ever to do this, to be able to televise a tank battle back straight into your living room back in, you know, Pasadena or wherever. It was good. And when I say it was good, it was scary. Funny enough, you know, all that time I was in the Corps, I had a pretty benign existence, really. I mean, you know, yeah, odd contact. The big gunfights and everything went out with the 70s. And for all that time, you know, you could count the contacts you had like on one hand. I mean, I didn't go to the Falklands. I know you guys went down there. And I was very interested in that last podcast of yours, because that put things into perspective for me, because you were talking about guys that were mates of mine that did go. And just it's just by luck that I wasn't there, because I'd only just left 4-1. 4-1 was disbanded. Everybody went to the, you know, scattered to the four winds. I ended up down at HMS Warrior, which was probably one of the only places I couldn't get out of to go and do anything, you know, despite my begging. Because I'd been a professional soldier for 10 years at that time. To me, it was just like, it's a bit like being trained as a concert pianist and all of a sudden somebody says, you're not going near any more pianos, mate, you know.
Yeah, gut-wrenching. Yeah. There were two guys, I believe, that fell in at Bickley with 4-2 Commando when they marched off famously to the South Atlantic. That was the order that Colonel Vaux gave. You know, I think it was, 4-2 Commando to the South Atlantic, right turn, quick march. And they marched off the playground and off down to the docks to get on the ships. And two of the guys that were with them had actually left the Corps years previously, were actually civilians, had gone down to Bogey Nights, I think, or somewhere like that in you know, down in Plymouth, and got some kit and just fell in. And it wasn't until the ships were at sea, and I think it was a Canberra, where the sergeant majors are trying to work out why they've got more blokes than they've got beds, that it got discovered.
Oh, that's a great story.
And they never sent them ashore. They kept them on board, I believe, and they weren't allowed to go ashore. They were employed as air sentries. There are guys all over the place that were desperate to get down there and get into it. Interesting enough, a lot of guys who did go had the opposite view once it started really kicking off. You know,
yeah,
I'd have actually swapped places. And surprisingly, a lot of people put the PBR chits in 4-5 after we came back. I heard more than one guy saying, "That's it, I've done it now. I don't need any more. I'm off. Goodbye."
We had this dust up that I was involved in. I was looking after a media team. I'll tell you an incident happened there that had a great effect on the way I thought about life. This guy who was the correspondent was a big Texan guy. Three young kids. Beautiful wife, you know, lived in New York, everything going for him. But he was a really nice fella. I took them for 2 weeks training in Kuwait before we went out. And at the end of it, like, we flipped a coin. One of us was going in the desert, one was staying in the hotel, and I got the one going in the desert. So we deployed. We spent, like, I don't know, 6 days before we went across the berm, sort of in isolation as such. This huge, you know, it was division. It was the third Infantry Division. Just sort of waiting to go out. I can remember the night the war started, seeing the Tomahawks coming over, and I was lying on my camp bed, just looking up at these things going. Anyway, then it was a mad dash. Everything was going off. I think about 8 days later, we ended up just by the Euphrates. They just fought their way in, basically. And everybody made more progress like that. It was almost like a blitzkrieg type thing, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it could have been from Gordon's playbook, you know, coordinated A-10s. You've got the missiles called an MRS that will destroy a kilometre, you know, and they go off in batteries. And then you've got like Paladins, you know, that fire a 120mm shell, you know, and they fire them, bang, 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 everything. Abrams tank. Poor Iraqis didn't have a chance, mate, to be honest. You know, they were just ripped apart, the whole thing, you know. And when we got to Euphrates, we had the first time we were on a hard ground, hard standing, and we were just sort of brewing up. And because we had satellite comms that looked like a biological laboratory at the time when everybody was looking for them, we nearly got lit up a few times, actually. I'm waiting to get on the phone. So David Bloom's there talking to his kids. I go to use the phone afterwards. He's walking across, and I thought he'd been shot, because it was just, he went from walking normally to lying in a spasm. So, immediately I thought, I didn't hear a shot. I thought, sniper, silencer, or I didn't really know what it was. But when we went over, it turned out he had an embolism, and this thing had dislodged itself from the leg. which we knew about, and he'd have been advised to go home because of it. He'd either got it on a flight into the country or got it cramped up in the other vehicle, which was a recovery tank that had all the main cameras and everything on it. He died, and I could remember thinking, you know, just 1 minute you're alive, and the next minute you're just dead. And when we were going through, because we were traveling at the very end of the train of this, of the battalion of 3rd ID, we were with the padre and all the, you know, medical staff and all the rest of it. We're going through the battlefield. It's full of dead people. It's just everybody is dead. You know, it's just like dead civilians who are in the wrong place at the wrong time, dead Iraqi soldiers, just young blokes, you know, 19, guys in their trenches, the blast. Some of these bomb runs and everything have just blown all the life out of them, you know, and there's not a mark on them. Just so weird. And that sort of plays on your mind a bit, because you realise that, you know, this really precious thing that you've got, life. Me and you have spent all our time involved in soldiering, which really it's all about taking it. And then all of a sudden you're in this situation where, you know, it's so random and haphazard that it could be anybody. It could be anybody at any time, you know? And the average civilian, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, I mean it in a factual way, they see somebody dead and it's going to be their dad or somebody they love or something, you know? And you know, I lost my younger brother when I was 21 and he was 19. But that's it. Then you realise that you go around and you see 100 dead bodies, 100 dead bodies. And you realise how precious life is. But you also realise how easy it is to be just snuffed out in a second.
It's interesting how that affects us, isn't it? I've helped guys that have served in Bosnia who were involved in exhuming mass graves.
But my son was involved in that, and that didn't really go down too well with him, I don't think.
Well, it's definitely had an effect with some of the people I've met too. It's hard for them to talk about. Yeah, shooting war is one thing when you're on one side and the enemy's on the other and they're wearing uniform, you can identify. A very, very sinister, nasty war, like where you can't identify the enemy and yet they've seemed to have all the upper cards. The risks that you're running all the time. And then you get the civilian side of it, where the civilians are the innocent people caught up in this. I had to develop a way of dealing with this in my own life. And it was all centered around that one event in the Falklands, but really everything else that I've been through, which previously wasn't an issue. I suppose in some ways when I was a young guy, it was almost a thrill. It was what I joined up to do. But as I got older and saw more, and then gradually that one event itself triggered everything off, suddenly it's all changed shape. It's you no longer see it that way. I mean, I had to develop a philosophy about killing. People often say to me, you lived on a boat for 18 years. Wow, you must have caught some fish. I said, not one. You know, I can go to the supermarket and buy a sardine in a tin. I don't need to kill a fish. Mm. And that takes some understanding. But the bottom line is that's my philosophy about it. You know, the only thing I'll kill today without any thought is a mosquito. Everything else I'll try and catch under a glass and let it go. And that's because of the change in my attitude over the years from what was originally just a gung-ho soldier, really, like all of us, to somebody that's seen it, I suppose, really, you know. So, I mean, how did you cope with all this stuff, Bernie? Because you had a similar sort of build-up of experiences, mate.
I just found it really, really exciting, I must admit. I found it really, really exciting because that's what I really wanted. I've been gifted because I can think through stressful situations. I've always been able to sort of rationalise and think about things. So my job was looking after my team. So that was my main priority. I kept myself busy doing that. You know, you're not interested in killing the enemy as such. You're just interested in keeping your people safe as they can be. And that was my priority. But I did find it really, really exciting. I mean, you know, you see things that nobody could ever think about seeing. An A-10 on a strafing run. Just being part of the whole machine going forward. And there's a couple of things that, you know, I've had arguments with people about, actually. People saying, you know, a couple of things. First of all, this idea that all the young American soldiers, you know, who were in my unit, and I do think of it as my unit, funny enough, because I identified with them. And I think even the most hardened journalist, once they got involved in the military, and they got a bit of Stockholm syndrome as well, I'm pretty sure, you know, because they just loved the guys that they were with. And that young 19-year-old guy from Arkansas or, you know, Georgia or somewhere, you know, whether it be black, white, we had such a diverse amount of soldiers there, you know, because you know, every nation you could think of on earth was reflected in that battalion. And they didn't think that they were, you know, doing it for Rumsfeld or doing it for this. They thought they were doing it for the Iraqi people. They really thought that. That was what they were told. They didn't think about, I'm going to kill everything I can come across. No, they didn't. The other thing is, this idea that the Iraqis were cowards or, you know, they gave up straight away. Well, of course they gave up straight away, wouldn't you? And one incident that really underlined both sides of that argument is the lead tank in Abrahams was run by, we used to call him Captain Jack, and he was like an Alabaman guy, you know, hunting, fishing, shooting, brilliant bloke, you know, really, really good. And he's in his, like, Abrams, he's a lead tank. So you've got the Abrams, then you've got the Bradleys. The Bradleys are getting ready to deploy either side because they've got the troops in them. He's going up, he's at the top of the tank, and he's looking out, and he sees this sidecar come out. And they're just going into Baghdad, I mean, not far from Baghdad. And a sidecar comes out, and it's two Iraqi soldiers. And he says, I don't believe I'm seeing this. So he closes down the thing, and he's looking through the prism. And he sees these guys. And you can see what they're doing. The guy's getting an RPG out, okay, in a sidecar next to his mate. And bang, RPG, he's got a good shot. Bang, he's hit the front glass plate. Gunner's a bit shot, right, okay. And he goes to engage him with a machine gun. He says, no, mate, don't. So that guy has got some guts, you know. Yeah. It was only when he reloaded the RPG and had another go, or Captain Jack said, yeah, light him up. And he did. When we come up, they were pointed out to me. What had happened was the tanks had gone over them. And I mean, I'm not talking about a tank. I'm talking about 30 or 40 Bradleys had rolled over these people. So I had this sort of biomechanical, biological mess of these two really brave soldiers that had died fighting for their country, as far as they were concerned.
We're reliant on your support to continue helping veterans living with PTSD. If you'd like to donate, please go to justgiving.com/The Mountain Way. We'd be very grateful.
So, I mean, there's always two sides to every story, isn't there?
But the moral issue is another element or part of the PTSD cloud, if you like, that I find guys I'm helping really want to talk about. Obviously, not everybody's affected by this. In fact, I've no idea of percentage, but I would say with confidence, the bulk of people who've been to war with the United Kingdom Armed Forces haven't had a problem with it, wherever it's been. They've managed to rationalize like you do. They've been able to sort of put things into context. They are what they are. They're proper soldiers and they don't have a problem with that, and leave the moral issue with the politicians where it belongs. And so it comes down to your personal experiences, and some people have worse experiences than others, but how you cope with that, it varies from individual to individual. But I think we are seeing a growing number of people, young people, who have become overwhelmed. And I think the thing that takes them over the edge isn't just from the horror point of view, as you just described, it is the moral side as well. It's the complexity of justification for being there in the first place. And perhaps older people, you know, of our generation, coming from tougher backgrounds. I mean, you came from the East End of London, correct me if I'm wrong there, Bernie. That's as hard a battleground as anywhere, you know. And I think that prepares you for a life of the sort we've experienced.
Yeah, I think people are different then. I mean, like I was in 4-5 in 74, as I said, you know, when I joined 4-5, it was probably 50% jock. 4-5 always is. So we had a pipe band, and all the officers wore Pringle tartan cravats and over the top, really. I mean, for a Londoner, I just thought, what the fuck am I joined here, you know? Great blokes. And, you know, there was a fair few of us from London. It was a different time. The 70s were a harder time for people. You know, life was tougher. And some of the guys in that unit were from Anderson's Town, you know, the Andy Town estate in Glasgow, the Gorbals, and absolutely brilliant blokes, but hard as nails. I said to you about PTSD thing, I think everybody's got an element of it, mate, to be honest. I know I've been worried about it. I mean, we've talked about it. It's something that everybody who's been involved in that sort of thing has elements of it. You know, I still have sleepless nights. getting up 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, where's the magazine to my weapon? And I realised I'm in Spain. I hadn't been in the military for 30 years, you know. Everybody gets that sort of thing. The thing yes. about Afghanistan and the amount of stuff that went over there, let me come forward slightly. So I spent the last 8 years of my working life working for Tim Collins, who's a great bloke. If you listen in, Tim, thanks, mate, because you give me some, you know, you employed me for 8 years. I really appreciate it. We were doing this HUMINT thing where we were training, first of all, the Iraqi intelligence services for 3 years. And then we went to Afghanistan and we worked with the Afghan army intelligence service and the army. But I'd done that for 8 years. I was forward based with either the US Marines or the British Army throughout that time. I spent the last 18 months, I think, in Kabul. But what I'm saying is, you see the effect of constant warfare. To be honest, you know, you'd go out Northern Ireland, West Belfast or Cross, you were hard targeting out that tiny little door. And it's a buzz because you know you're under threat, you know you're under danger. So exactly the same, going out the gate in Afghanistan is the same, but you know you have got probably a 70% chance of being in a gunfight that day.
Some of the guys I spoke to, mate, have talked about a 100% chance actually yeah. going out with tourniquets already on their limbs.
I was there when that incident with Al Blackman happened. I was out there at that particular time. They were up at Nari Siraj and they were getting thrashed. I don't mean they weren't capable of doing it, but they were getting contacts most days. And the guys cope with it really well. The way you don't cope with it is when you come back home and all of a sudden, A, you miss it slightly, which is really, really strange.
Yeah.
You're with your family. You don't feel normal.
Yeah.
Because you feel like you've done something or whatever. They can't relate to you because you've been through that experience.
That's right.
And I think people with PTSD, severe PTSD, would be people who were the most, who were in the shit the most, basically. That level of warfare was right back to sort of Second World War levels. Winston Churchill was like, 99% warfare is boredom and mundanity, and then the other 1% can kill you. Well, these guys win that 1% for a fucking long time.
Yeah, that's right.
And although they will never get rid of the friendships and the great thing that came from that, when people denigrate that at home and say you shouldn't have been there anyway, or they're not served in a shop, you know, because people know they're in the Marines, that's when it hurts them. That's when you can get that adverse reaction. Or they say, well, what was the point of doing it? Your government sends you there because you're a soldier. Or you're volunteered to be a soldier. You've got no problem with being there. But then suddenly everything changes, you know, and the moral high ground goes to the, you know, mainstream media. It's great. They always support you if you're a serviceman, but then they denigrate everything that you stand for, you know, and they chip away at the very reasons that you went there. These guys went there because they thought they'd fight. I've never believed that, by the way. You know, I've done a master's in terrorism studies, and I know that it doesn't work that way. You're not fighting the Taliban in Helmand because they're going to pitch up in Borehamwood High Street. They're nationalist in intent. What they were told was, you know, we'll fight terrorism there because, you know, it'll be back on our streets. Well, that worked out really well, didn't it? Because it did come to our streets. And now people are even justifying it happened, you know. I find it very frustrating. I've talked to this before, mate, in some of our chats, you know. I put on Sky News in the morning just to get my ire up. And I think, how many ways can they slant the story, you know, in such a way? Or, you know, the BBC's worse. You know, I don't know. Anyway, I've had my rant now. What I'm saying is that PTSD is a real thing. You can see somebody who's wounded. You can see blood. You can see a chest wound. You can see a leg blown off. You know, you've seen all that. We've seen all this stuff, okay? But you can't see mental wounds. And it's the mental wound that can be the most damaging. That's the one that can kill you. And do you know what I like about your program, mate? I think it's great that you can go to a National Health Service guy and you can talk about your war experiences, or you can go into a trauma tank, or you can do something, you know, go through what made you feel that way. But the person who's talking to you doesn't know your experiences. What they've done is they've done a course about the brain, about human reactions to this, that and the other, and then they try and get your experience and fit it into one that's similar to something they know about, and you will know it. People like us, we know the problem, and you then can get in there and just, the guy knows he's talking to somebody who comes from that background, okay, which I think is hugely important, and you can understand what, you know, what he's feeling. I know there's some great therapists out there and everything, you know, but if you're going to talk about warfare and you're going to talk us to really take somebody through, you know, how they're feeling at it, then I think you should be part of it. And that's why I want to support the Mountain Way. And that's why my son is supporting Mountain Way, because, you know, you're going to get it right. It's you that's that light at the end of their tunnel, mate. And their tunnel's fucking long and dark because they've been in it for years. You can have it and not know you're doing it. You can run your life. You can have some miserable times and not know why. You could be at a birthday party, a kiddie's birthday party, and everybody's having a great time. But you could feel pissed off and you don't know why.
Yeah.
It's because, A, your mates have died and you haven't, all the suffering that you've seen, and you don't think it's right to enjoy yourself like that. Well, I've known you 40-odd years. I know you're a genuine bloke. I know you know what you're doing. And it's far better to take that one person who's really reached the end of his tether, who will be a fatality of a war that happened 10 years ago. And that's why we've got to make the effort to get this done, you know. And that's why we're doing this podcast.
Exactly, Bernie. May I just want to thank you for all that. I mean, that is a really succinct insight into this problem from somebody who definitely knows and somebody who's been there and wears a T-shirt. So thanks again for that, mate. And you've just touched on guilt, and straight away you can see how complex that is and how wide it is. And mentioning the triggers, well, they're infinite. Every single person's got a different set, and most people don't even know it. That's an important part of what I do, is try to help them discover that, because until they know what they are, they can't avoid them. It applies to their families as well, because the families often trigger off things without even realizing it. And it's a no-win situation. This is why the relationships fail and tragically, in some cases, take their own life. Yeah, I wish there was a greater, wider understanding at the higher level of a better way of dealing with this. But, you know, I think this applies right across the whole of the mental health industry in any case. Pills and potions can help. There's no doubt about that. Particularly in emergency cases, you can help people just cope with the absolute nightmare they're living with. But it's not the solution. It's only a temporary stopgap. I helped one guy who was on 27 pills a day. I was shocked when I saw this booklet that he was issued, which had blister packs in it. And there were certain times of the day when he had to take certain pills. Half of those pills apparently were there to sort of counteract the side effect of the other half. So it was a real vicious circle. I saw him earlier on this year. He's come a heck of a long way, and all credit to him. He's really done most of the work, and he's been through some very tough times since he came out to France with me. And he's down to 10 now, which is a huge improvement. You were saying earlier on about everybody who's been to war suffers to some extent with PTSD. I think that's absolutely true. Mm. Because I'm seeing comments now from guys who formerly said, oh, I'm all right, no problems at all, and starting to see things.
I would have never said that a couple of years ago. No, I just thought, listen, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. That was my...
classic attitude.
That was my attitude at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't think I had a problem.
I didn't for 14 years, mate.
While I was either, you know, working in Baghdad or Kabul, and I was going out and doing that all the time, that didn't faze me. To be honest, it didn't faze me, because that was me doing my job. It was when I was at home that it affected me. You know, I never made a bad decision because, you know, I'm scared about this, or I don't want to get blown up today, or whatever, you know. All these various other things that go through. I'm just getting on. I'm doing my job, you know. And because I'm doing my job, I'm focused. But when you get back and you get back to your family, they're the people that bear the brunt of it. They're the people that can see you're not sleeping properly. They're the ones that get snapped at and they get shouted at because, you know, you're not in the, what do you know about it, sketch.
Yeah. Well,
why are we doing this? I don't want to do this. We talked about meditation. I tell you what book helped me a lot was Marcus Aurelius' Meditations. There's very little in the human mind that hasn't been thought about a very long, long time ago. I don't think a Roman guy, you know, in the Germanic wars as a soldier has got any sort of different thoughts than us. He just writes it in Latin and in a different way, you know. Or even going back to Socrates, my friend, take care of your psyche, know thyself. For once we know ourselves, we may learn to care for others. We talked about meditation. I'm not going to sit down, you know, in a fucking lotus pose and but I couldn't anyway, mate.
No, no, me neither.
Sometimes I go to the gym, I go for a run, and that's when I think about things. Oh, at the moment, this will make you laugh. I got a leak on my old BMW, and the neighbours have complained about this stain, you know, on the road. I don't blame it. It's unsightly. So every day I've come back and I'm scrubbing it. You know, I get soap, I get sand, and I scrub away at it. And, you know, I do half an hour. I tell you what, it's blissful. It's like proper meditation, you know, because I'm not thinking about anything, doing that stain and just having a bit of headspace. It's mundane. It's sort of frees your mind up a wee bit. And I do that. And the good news is the stain's going nowhere. Now, I believe in that. I think, you know, you have to get in and clear your own mind out.
Well, I think it's very important for people to love themselves. And when I talk to our guests about that, you can see the kind of surprise in their eyes.
Yeah.
Because some of them actually think, well, I do love myself. But when we start talking about issues, it's very obvious they don't.
Remember, mate, I was a PTI. I've always loved myself.
That's one of the main entry requirements, isn't it? If you don't love yourself, you'll never get in. Doesn't matter how fit you are. You're just a lump of muscle that everybody was terrified of.
I was 34 before I passed my PTT's course. So
that's pretty outrageous, yeah. 34.
It is, actually, yeah. My classmates on that thing, you know, will agree with us, you know, gymnastics and shit like that just was not me, you know.
My mate Paul Denning, who was CEO of 4-3 Commando, you know, he invited our batch up to Helensburgh and he arranged a weekend for us. It was brilliantly done. We did everything. I don't know many people that have driven a 16,000-ton nuclear hunter-killer submarine, but I have. All right, okay, it was a simulator, to be honest. But, you know, crash-dive the bloody thing, mate. It was just like the boat. It was great. Alarms going off and everything. The piece de resistance was he found a PTI that remembered the PT we used to do, and we went through that routine. So when it came to the vaulting over the box, there was one of us who remained numbness, who couldn't do it, and he just ran at it. And the top lid opened, and he fell inside, and it shut, and he just vanished inside the box. Local members of the RMA branch, they all clapped, of course. They thought that was a brilliant manoeuvre.
I love the PT branch. They're just insane, mate. It was just really, really comical stuff. We had these things, Viking challenges. And, you know, you'd all put in the morning, like tea break in the morning, okay, what's today's Viking challenge? And then you climb 30 ropes today during the day. That must be verified by another PTI. Or run across the X and back, you know, at low tide. Or 1,000 burpees in such a minute. And, it was great fun. I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed my time on the staff, definitely, yeah. And they're unique people. One of the really great quotes from Marcus Aurelius to do with us is, the happiness of your life depends on the quality of your thoughts. And I think sometimes we lose that. People lose that. They always think the worst of themselves. They always look inward. They always think about that, the things that they haven't done, not things they've achieved. They're looking inward instead of outward.
I need to study Marcus Aurelius. We've all read Sun Tzu, of course. I try to help our people understand that you're not your thoughts.
No.
And the analogy I use is Star Trek. And I've got a picture of, you know, the flight deck of the Starship Enterprise and Captain Kirk sat in his chair with the crew around him. And they're looking at a big screen. Yeah. And that's my point, you know, that you're in the chair, but your thoughts are on the screen. In other words, they're separate to you. You can control that. And again, it's just the starting of the awareness of the fact that if you don't make that separation, then you can't take control of them. And if you want to get back to that point of the quality of your life, then definitely you've got to control those thoughts. Meditation is one of the ways of doing it, actually.
Yeah, I think, and he was, he was a Stoic, wasn't he? Which I think the majority of bootnecks are Stoics.
Yes.
The majority of paras are Stoics. It's only when you're really in the shit that you really think you're alive.
You get kind of almost addicted to it in some ways. And I think that's another element that's not helpful. Once you've left the service, what really needs to happen there is a complete readjustment of your thinking. And that's why I coined the phrase Zen warrior. I'm not a Zen expert. I mean, the more you read about it, the more confused I am. My personal view is it's about expanding beyond the soldierly level. So we've all done the drinking, fighting bit, if you like. That kind of sums it up, doesn't it? It's now developing yourself as a human being. If you think of samurai, you know, they were wonderful swordsmen, great horsemen, martial artists, but they were also poets, musicians, calligraphers, that kind of thing. And that's what I'm trying to encourage our guys to do, is to fill that very gap that you just alluded to about the fact that, you know, your thoughts are really, they're there. But if you don't do something with them, that's all you're going to get. You're going to go round and round like a washing machine, the same old spin cycle, seeing the same old horrors.
Well, I've got control over it. There's another one from Marcus Aurelius here. Look well into thyself. There is a source of strength that always spring up if thou wilt always look. I get great comfort from these. The happiness of your life depends on the quality of your thoughts. And, you know, if a guy can work it out in the Germanic wars, you know, in a forest in Germany.
Well, we've all seen Gladiator. In some senses, those are almost the best scenes in the film. You've obviously done this by becoming a writer. The writing you've chosen to do is very much related to your past, and that's why you speak with authority And I think that's why your books are popular, because people obviously recognise that straight away.
How did I get into writing? I always loved writing at school and stuff like that, you know. And my favourite book, Janet and John, book one.
I was going to say, did you pass NAMIT?
No. No, I don't think I did. No, I did, yeah.
I only had one O-level when I joined up, mate. And that was given to me.
I didn't take advantage of the educational thing at all in the core. And I should have done. And I was offered it, but I never did. I always had this, I don't know, sort of inverted snobbery about me, I suppose. You know, not in a nasty way, but, you know, I was what I was. But when I did get a few bob and I earned some money, I decided that I would properly educate myself. So I've done that over a period of time. And like, you know, I did do a risk management MSc, and then I'd done an MLit at St. Andrews, which I loved. It was a Master of Letters. It's to do with Terrorism Study Centre. I'll tell you what I found I like writing, but, you know, academic writing is so stifling. Where do I get that quote to make that point? Having done that, I thought I would really like to write a book. What should I write it on? Well, obviously, you know, you have to reflect your own experiences because you need to know about stuff. So The first book, A Shadowing of Angels, is a book that looks at various things, including PTSD. It's a hostage extraction out of Mosul in 2014. Now, I was out there in 2008, 2009. I was actually in Mosul. So I know the area, I know the thing. And when we were out there, actually, with that job that I talked about with NCC, that was the start. That's when we first seen the start of ISIS. And we seen how Al-Qaeda was transmuting into this more virulent form of ISIS. It's an adventure novel, basically. Like, it's a good old, like, adventure novel. But it's based on an intelligence-type background. The primary character is a woman special forces soldier. And I'd done that deliberately because I was a typical bootneck. Everybody used to get on really well with the Wrens, you know, at Deal or whatever, you know, at Limpston, good girls, you know, sports days and all that sort of stuff. But I'd never worked alongside women at all until I'd done special duties. They totally blew me away, you know, because they were doing the same stuff as me. Their hands were all calloused from firing a 9mm pistol all day, the same as me. We all smelt this sort of slightly of gun smoke in the evening where we're cleaning weapons. And it was just like, they were just absolutely really good comrades. These people were professional soldiers. They separated their lives same as we did. So I wanted to reflect that in my book. And then I just really enjoyed being out the strictures of academia so I could just write the way I wanted to write. So the first book was a good experience. You know, the second book, A Falling of Angels, takes it one step further in adventures. It features an attack on London, but I try and get into the psyche of the suicide bomber. I don't want to just go, he's a bad guy, you know, I hate him. I try and get into the psyche of it a bit. And that's the book, mate, that half the income for that book that I get for the first 500 copies is going to go to the Mountain Way. And I think we should be able to get somebody away and get some help with that sort of money.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And I'm teamed up with my son. He's Letchworth Garden City. He runs a big gym there. He's money raising as well for it. The third book is coming on okay. I'm doing really well with it. And I think of another great, bright plot. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm back into rewriting it. So now that will come out pretty soon. The first book is on audio. The second book comes out on Audible. We hope for in about a couple of weeks' time. Yeah, I find writing a release. I know you do. I know I really liked your book, The Man in the Mist. I thought that was a great book, especially if you want to understand anything about the Falklands. I thought that was good.
Well, I'm interested to talk about your experiences there because thank you for that, by the way. It was a cathartic exercise rather than a serious attempt at being a groundbreaking novelist of any sort.
Do you know something? It'll be great to, you know, become a groundbreaking novelist, but do you know my books won't hit that, mate. I wrote my book because that's the sort of book I would like to read. I've read lots of military stuff. I thought Bravo 2-0 was a great book, but then some of the dross that come after that, not that particular author, Mitch, don't get annoyed, mate. Some of it's written by people who know nothing about the military. So, you know, if I get to, I'm really enjoying a book. It's really, really well written. Okay. And I love the way it flows. I love the way the conversations are going. And I think this is different. You know, it's not whatever. And then it'll get to chapter 3. And the guy will say, a private in the SAS walked up the road. And I just go, do you know what I mean? or is something wrong with one of the weapons?
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, it's obviously somebody who just can't be bothered to do any research. So I've sort of done that. It's going okay. We should be able to get somebody away if things. I'm going to be hitting it on my websites. My website is www.wtdelaney, which is my pen name, .com. So you can get hold of all the books and all that on that website. This is what we're not good at, Andy, is self-promotion. We come from a generation where it goes against the grain slightly to do it.
We didn't take many selfies, did we?
No. I haven't got anything really left. You know, I've got some...
I've got a single photograph from the Falklands.
Yeah.
And I've only got a couple from Northern Ireland.
Yeah. And that's all I've got. I haven't even got them anymore. And they're generally what other people have taken and they've sent.
That's right.
Younger listeners, they have to remember that before the digital revolution, there were very few cameras in the core, really, was there? Do you know what I mean? It's nothing you did. I mean, you might have had one of them Instamatic things that you took on tour with you.
I took a bunch of lads down to Bordeaux to retrace the Cockleshell Heroes route from 40 Commando.
Yeah.
We really saw some fantastic things and we uncovered a bit of history. But on the section between where Hazard and Sparks ditched the canoes, at a place called Blay, and where they entered the French resistance circuit in a place called Ruffec, there was about 150 miles between. And we ran that. And it was in February 89. Beautiful weather. We were in just Union Jack shorts. Everybody else around there was still wearing furs. So we attracted quite a bit of attention. Afterwards, I went to Boots and put in the Pentax. These things weren't cheap. Developing was expensive as well. Put the film in to be developed. And I went to pick it up a few days later and the girls were all sniggering. And I thought, oh God, what's in there?
One of the blokes had got hold of the camera.
Yeah, one of them had got hold of it, mate. And we had these big bottles of Kaz lemonade and orange and stuff we were drinking because we were running, you know, it was 150 miles. It was a good phys exercise and it was very warm and obviously a lot of perspiration, so a lot of drinking going on. Anyway, I don't want to go too graphic about this, but anyway, I looked through the photographs. There were three backsides with these bottles jammed up them. Oh, God. And then obviously I'd come back in and had a good old swig.
Oh, horrible, aren't they?
Yeah. Cameras, that's why we didn't have cameras in those days, yeah.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. Bernie, that's been a fantastic chat, mate. I really enjoyed talking to you about all this stuff again. Your website is www.wtwhiskeytangodelaney.com. If you're interested in Bernie's books, which are thoroughly recommended, please go there and purchase one. You're also helping him to help the Mountain Way, which will help somebody overcome the complex military PTSD. Thank you very much, mate, and wish you all the best with your next book.
Andy, can I just say, of all the things that are cathartic in my life, is a big long chat with you. I know we've done it a couple of times. You know, it's good fun, mate. It does clear my mind as well. So I know you're the right man for the job, buddy.
I love your Marcus Aurelius stuff, mate. Got to have more of that.
All right. God bless you, mate.
Cheerio, mate.
Cheerio, buddy.
If you'd like to find out more about the Mountain Way, do visit our website, www.mountainway.org. If you'd like to request more information, please do email us at info@mountainway.org and we'll send you our PDFs of information. And do follow us on social media. If you need support now, reach out to charities such as Samaritans, Mind, or your GP.